Why is the study of the book of Genesis important? The beginning of what?
Everything. Life, earth, sin.
About the beginning of God?
No.
Oh. About the beginning. In the prayer we just prayed with John, he talked about us revering God. How does Genesis show the importance of that? Is the Creator? How did Moses write the book to show the that point? I mean, what? Where is about chapter 10 or what?
In the very beginning.
In the first chapter of the book. Who's he writing it for?
Jews.
What?
The Israelites.
Why do they need it? So they'll fear him and keep his commandments. That's certainly correct. They're already leaning that direction. They're already fully devoted to him, aren't they? And when Moses writes this?
No.
Where have they been for the last couple hundred years?
They were in Egypt for 400 years.
In Egypt. What were they surrounded by?
Idolatry.
In idolatry. Did this God you're reading about create the universe? He did?
Yep.
And idolatry?
Oh.
This God you read about right here in Genesis.
Created the universe, yes.
And idolatry?
He did not create idolatry. Man
provided. I'm going to ask you who created idolatry. In idolatry, did this God create the universe?
No.
And they needed to know who created the universe. Including man. This is foundational. When Paul wanted to discuss the gospel of Christ in the book of Romans, where did he start in chapter 1?
The creation.
The creation. Where Genesis starts. That's right. And so this is foundational. The book of Genesis is extremely important to fundamental concepts about the Creator God, about man and who he is, about his responsibilities and capabilities, about what sin is, what the consequences of sin are, and about God's plan or remedy for man's sin, the scheme of redemption. So, beginning in chapter 12 of the book, where we've been studying, what is the what thread is being followed beginning in chapter 12?
Abraham and his descendants.
Why would I care about Abraham and his descendants? I'm not a Jew.
The covenant that God made with Abraham.
What?
The covenant that God
made with Abraham to give him the land? I'm not getting that either, so why am I interested in that? What? The nation of Israel would be blessed, but I'm not part of the nation of Israel, so why do I care about that?
Through his seed, all will be blessed.
In his seed, all will be blessed. Who does that include?
Us.
I said the nations. I didn't say.
You said nations?
I said the nations.
I stand corrected. She had an S on it. No, I don't want one of those. Okay. So Nadine had it right. She said nations. That's right. And so we talked about that, in fact, in our last class when we were talking about chapter 17. So Genesis is indeed foundational, very important book to study to get our thinking on the right track. All right, today we're looking at chapters 18 and 19 of the book. We have here three main divisions, as you see on your outline. 1 through 15 of chapter 18, the angels visit Abraham and Sarah and assure the birth of the son of promise. Okay, and then why would they need assurance?
Because God
Because they were old by this time.
What do you mean old? Like 53?
100.
Okay. Back in the previous chapter, he said he was 99. But, I mean, if God made the promise to him last week, what's the big deal?
It's been years.
How many years?
25.
At least 25. That's right. So, God's going to appear to them and assure them of the birth of the child between Abram and Sarah. And so Abram had tried to help God along with his own plan, which was
Eliezer
would be his heir. Sarah decided to try to help God out with her plan. What was that? Through Hagar, have a son. Neither of which was God's plan. All right, so that's the first part of chapter 18. The second part of chapter 18 and into the 19th chapter, very significant historical event, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and we'll have occasion to look at that as we go through our lesson. And then a very sad event, chapter 19 at the end, Lot begat children through his two daughters, which became, their descendants became the Moabites and the Ammonites. All right, so let's begin by looking. We have some suggested marking. Again, many of you may not mark. That's okay if you don't. It's just a useful tool. I do want to note something here on this third thing that I have for marking. We had suggested that you mark three men. You see that in verse 2. Three men. And then that you mark the nouns and pronouns referring to these three men. And so if you did that, what would be your first marking?
Verse 1.
What in verse 1?
Lord.
The Lord. Verse 2 says three men. That's the way they appeared to Abraham. But one of those individuals that looked like a man was the Lord. Now, what's unique about the way the Lord's spelled in your Bible? All capitals, which means it's Jehovah. That's right. And so the Lord appeared to Abraham. And when I read this again, and I've read it, of course, I don't know how many times through the years. It's still amazing to me that Abraham, a man on the earth, could have a conversation with the creator of the universe who appeared there as a man. But that's what you have on this particular occasion. And rather extended conversation with him. So besides verse 2, look at what's the next pronoun that you would mark?
Him.
When? Where?
In verse 2.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that one. Them. Thank you, Rocky. Them in verse 2. I went down to verse 10.
It's actually two thems in verse 10.
Okay. All right, so that's good that you noticed that, and I missed that. One of them is in italics, so I'm only half wrong. But anyway, then you get down to verse 10. What's significant about that pronoun?
Singular.
It is singular. What's the pronoun? Verse 10.
I.
What's I going to do? What's I going to do?
Provide a son.
Provide a son to who?
Sarah.
What's so unusual about that?
90 years old.
90 years old. Abraham will be 100. Beyond the time of childbearing. I will. Who? That's verse 1. The Lord. All right. And then you come down to verse 13. You have it again. The Lord. And verse 14, is anything too difficult for the Lord? At the appointed time, here's another pronoun, I. will return to you. And then you have in verse 17 following some others that occur there. The Lord talking about what he would reveal to Abraham about Sodom and Gomorrah. But then when you get down a little bit further in the text, in verse 22, if you did this marking, it becomes very interesting. The men turned away from there and went toward Sodom. How many of the men?
Two.
Look at chapter 19, verse 1. What were these two men? Two angels. What did they look like? Did they have wings? They look like men. Have you ever seen an angel? How do you know? I don't know. Anyway, these men were angels. And so they look like men. They look like men to Lot as well. But you have the Lord and two angels that appeared here in a discussion with Abram. Now then, verse 23 of chapter 18. Now Abraham was standing at the end of verse 22 before who? That left who? The Lord. So he was one of the three. And so verse 23, Abraham came near and said, will you? Who's he talking to?
God.
The Lord. Isn't it interesting that Abraham was standing right there talking to them? And what is the nature of this conversation? What would you call it if you had to title it?
Persuasive argument.
A persuasive argument? It's a good way to do it.
Intercession.
It's a prayer, isn't it? Intercessory prayer. Persuasive argument is good as well. An intercessory prayer to Jehovah God. And he's talking to God like God's a rational being. And Rocky's made the point that there was somewhat of a back and forth exchange going on between God and Abram. So this was not a book prayer. It got out of a book somewhere. It was not a rote prayer. This was a conversation with God. And this is the way we ought to believe in God. That we can talk to God. Maybe he's not standing there, but distance is nothing to God. And we see Abraham interceding with God. What does he call the person he's talking to in verse 25?
Judge of all the earth.
So if you're doing this marking, that just jumps out at you. The one Abram's talking to determines the destiny of all men. You're the judge of all the earth. And so, verse 26, the Lord said, verse 27, I have ventured to speak to the Lord. And verse 30, oh, may the Lord not be angry. Verse 31, and 32, and 33, the Lord. So, very interesting as you read about this interchange. It starts out as if three men just happened to be in the neighborhood. Came to Abraham's tent. And Abraham said, let's practice some hospitality. Let's prepare him a meal. Make him comfortable. But it was far more than that. Now, on your lesson, we have Hebrews 13:2. So turn over to Hebrews 13:2. How did this chapter begin? How does it begin? That's not a hard question.
Do not neglect hospitality.
How does the chapter begin?
Let
love of the brethren continue. The people to whom this letter is written, what are they facing?
Persecution.
Hold your finger here. We're going to come right back to it. Go to 1 Peter chapter 1. When you obey the truth, you purify your soul to what? Verse 22. That's right. Purified your souls for a sincere love of the brethren. Look at chapter 4 of 1 Peter, verse 8. What does he tell them there? Keep fervent in your love for one another. What were the people Peter was writing to facing?
Suffering,
the world of temptation, intimidation, being maligned. Isn't it interesting that here in Peter and over here in James, to help people face the opposers that they would face, people who do not share their faith, let love of the brethren continue. I love my brethren. Remember that fellow we talked about Sunday? Those two boys? Go work in my vineyard. What did one of them say? I will. Aye, sir. Call on me. Did he go?
No.
No. I love the brethren. Well, according to Hebrews 13:2, what's one way to demonstrate that?
Hospitality.
Do not neglect. And again, it may not be a purposeful thing that we don't practice it. It may just be neglect. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. For by this some have entertained angels without knowing it. Without knowing it. What do you reckon he's talking about? What we're studying tonight. Abraham. Genesis 18. So here's practicing hospitality. In this particular case it was angels. But hospitality is encouraged among brethren as a means of strengthening ourselves in an ungodly world. Yes, sir, Todd?
So did Abraham at some point realize who he was entertaining?
Evidently in that conversation later he did, because he's making an intercessory prayer to spare the city. You wouldn't ask a fellow human being to do that. Good question. You agree? I don't know when it came to him. I do not understand. I just know at the first there's no indication that he did. But when he began to say the things that he said to him, like in verse 10, that's not what a human being could do. And so a good observation. We don't know exactly when that Abraham was aware of that. When he said, my Lord, in verse 3, that's just a term of respect, not Jehovah, my Lord. So anyway, I found it interesting, and I don't know what to tell you more about it. Just interesting to me. Now, Abraham's how old?
99.
He's got you beat, Doris. 99. And look at verse 2. When he saw these men, he did what? What did he do?
He ran.
Ran? There's a sense of zeal in this. He ran to the tent door, from the tent door to meet them, and bowed himself to the earth. Said, my Lord, if now I've found favor in your sight, please do not pass your servant by. Then he talked about bringing some water so they could wash their feet, rest themselves, eat some food. Verse 5, they said they'd do as he had said. And it's interesting now when you get to 6, Abraham what?
Hurried
into the tent of Sarah, said, quickly prepare 3 measures of flour. What in verse 7? Abraham also what?
Ran
to the herd. End of the verse. He hurried to prepare it. All through here you see Abraham's devotion to hospitality. And say, well, that was their culture. And it was their culture. But Hebrews is to Christians. You say, well, that's Hebrew Christians. What about 1 Peter?
Gentile
Christians. So we're not off the hook by saying, oh, that's the Jewish culture. And Hebrews is to Hebrew Christians. We've got 1 Peter over here too. And Romans 12 talks about hospitality among Christians. Who had a comment?
Also think about Abraham and his stature, right? He's a very rich man, head of the household, he's doing all those things. So not only is he doing all these things, but his stature, he doesn't have any pretense. It's humility.
Very good observation, Rocky. A very wealthy man at this time, wasn't he? Man highly regarded. And yet there's such humility and the desire to serve. That's a good point, Rocky. And I appreciate you mentioning that. Yes, Ennis?
You see Jesus Christ wash the feet of the apostles.
That's a good point, Ennis. Yes, Jesus washed their feet and was teaching them humble service when he did that. Good observation. Excellent. All right, so verse 10, here's that assurance. I'll return to you at this time next year. All right, so look at chapter 21, verse 5. How old was Abraham when Isaac was born? 100. Okay, so back up in chapter 17, verse 24, 99. And so now a time frame's put on it. There was no time frame in Genesis 12 or 15 or 17, but now there's a time frame put on it. I'll return to you this time next year. So at this time next year, if Sarah didn't have a son, what would Abraham know?
The Lord's a liar.
Huh?
The Lord is a liar.
The Lord is a liar, or? It wasn't the Lord. Right?
Right.
It was a pretender.
I don't think that would affect his faith.
I agree with you. I doubt that it would. He would just recognize that it was a pretender. But by at this time next year, if he had a son, he would know. Now, when Moses wrote this, of course, it was past history. And verified, not only by Abraham, but by the birth of Isaac and Isaac's son Jacob and Jacob's descendants. And so when Moses wrote it, a nation had come forth from Isaac's seed.
But the details God gave us in the Word, it may not have been known by these people.
Sir?
The details that were given to us by God in His Word, the Pentateuch, may not have been known by these people, even though they'd already happened.
Help me out, Ennis. I'm not sure. These people who?
The people that are reading this, that may have been living in that time, they may not know the details. They might have been.
You mean the Israelites that Moses is writing for? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how much they do about this, but last 200 years, I've been in Egypt. I don't know how many of them even had an education. They were slaves. And now Moses is setting forth this law. And so if they hadn't heard about it, and Moses wrote this, what did he do to ensure they would hear it again and again and again? Wrote it in a book, and then what to do with the book? It was to be read to all the people, everybody who could hear. Right? And so, if they didn't know, and this may be exactly right about that, Moses was ensuring, God was ensuring through the pen of Moses, that you would hear. You know, we talked about the importance of the book of Genesis. You believe in divine providence, do you not? We are seeing it all through the book of Genesis. You hold in your hand a book. no other book in the world like it. And so if you were going to organize a book for all generations of people that affected their lives here and eternally, what would be the first entry? God put Genesis as the first entry. That's interesting, isn't it? And so, verse 11 says they were past childbearing. So Sarah laughed. After I become old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also. I'm married to an old man and I'm an old woman. I'm going to have children? Ha ha. The Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh? How did he know she laughed? He's God. He knows every expression, everything we say or whisper or do. And so, his question, verse 14, is anything too difficult for the Lord? Is there anything I can't do? At the appointed time, I will return to you. Look at verse 15. Sarah denied it, however, saying, I did not laugh. Why did she say that? So that made it okay?
No.
No. And so Sarah lied. Sometimes good people lie. They shouldn't. Doesn't justify it. Sarah lied. And it's interesting that in spite of her failure, in spite of her weakness, God continued with his plan. So the men, verse 16, rose up from there and looked down toward Sodom. Abram was walking with them to send them off. You have a very interesting discussion here in verse 18. Verse start 17. Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Did he need to get Abraham's approval?
No.
Why would he discuss it with Abraham?
Because of Lot.
Because of Lot? So what?
It was somebody that he had a lot of feelings for.
That's true. We see a discussion pertaining to Lot. Good. An intercessory prayer following. What reason does God give in this discussion? Look down at verse 19. How does that verse begin? What's the first word?
For.
Shall I tell Abraham what I'm going to do? For. I have chosen him so that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice. What's the next two words?
So that
the Lord may bring upon Abraham what he had spoken about him. So if his descendants do not keep the word of the Lord, and if Abraham fails in that, what does not only this text, but as you study throughout the Bible, the book of Jeremiah, the book of Amos, over and over, what does God do to a nation of people that do not obey?
Bring judgment.
Brings destruction. What'd you say?
Bring judgment.
Brings judgment upon them. But God has a plan for his nation to come from Abraham. And so he's going to tell Abraham what he's going to do. And in this intercessory prayer, this, as Rocky put it, this argumentative discussion, a lesson is brought home to Abraham. If you had to sum up the lesson about that Abraham learned from this discussion with the Lord beginning in verse 22 through the end of the chapter, What lesson was brought without question home to Abram as far as the God's dealings with a nation or a city?
He knows everything.
What? Well, he knows everything. That's a good answer. It's not the one I'm thinking about, but that's true.
He keeps his promise.
What? My question is not good, is it? That's a good answer.
He holds them accountable for their actions.
Oh, man, I tell you what. I don't know how to ask this question. All your answers are good. What's going to save a city?
Righteousness.
What's going to save Abraham's descendants then?
Righteousness.
Abraham, here's the key. Command your children, your household, after you, so I can bring upon you the promise that I want to fulfill. And so here's an indelible lesson. So Abraham starts pleading. And so you see that. Verse 26, if I find 50 righteous in the city, then I'll spare the whole place on their account. Spare the whole. I don't know how big those cities were. I don't know if they were 10,000 or 100,000. But he said, I'll spare the whole city. For 50? Yeah. And then he moves down, you see. You get down to verse 28. What about if it's only 45? Well, I won't destroy it for that. Verse 20. Now, what if it's 40? Well, he won't destroy it. He'll save it for the 40. And verse 30. God is patient, isn't he? What about 30, Lord? And he said, I'll do it for 30. So Abram knows he's pressing his luck here. He says, now behold, I ventured to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are found there. He said, I'll destroy it on 20. And finally got down to 10, verse 32. Isn't this interesting? He said, I'll save those cities for 10 righteous people. You pray for America? God bless America. You don't fight in war. You don't fly airplanes. You don't shoot guns. What's the best thing you can do to save America?
Be righteous.
You say, but we're just so small. 10? I don't know what God's plans are. And so, very interesting lesson. I have on your sheet, Proverbs 14:34. You can quote that one, can't you? Righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. And I have all these verses in Amos. We're not going to have time to read them all, but go over there right quick. Look over at the book of Amos. This is so strongly emphasized in Amos' prophecy. Verse 3, thus says the Lord, for 3 transgressions of Damascus and for 4, I will not revoke its punishment. Why is Damascus going to have judgment? Transgressions. They had reached their limit. Verse 6, for 3 transgressions of Gaza and for 4, I'll not revoke its punishment. You go down, it's over and over and over again. Judgment's coming because they've reached their limit. So, we have here back in the book of Genesis an initial story that talks about God's rule and the affairs and the kingdoms of men and the principles upon which He operates. Sodom and Gomorrah. All right, we're in chapter 19. Now, these two angels come to Sodom in the evening. Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. Lot saw them. He rose to meet them, bowed down with his face to the ground. What does he do in verse 2? What does he practice?
Hospitality.
Yes, Todd?
One question about the last chapter. So we have God in flesh talking to the father of the Jewish nation. But at the time of Jesus, the Jews accused him of blasphemy and said, you being man, make yourself out to be God. I've always wondered why there was this disconnect when in their own law they had this moment where their creator
in the flesh makes this promise to your fleshly father?
Good question. I don't have the answer. I think I know part of it. If Jesus in the flesh had promised, wait just a little while, we're going to destroy Rome and you'll be free from taxes, they might have accepted him. They didn't like what Jesus came for. We studied Sunday about John the Baptist, and these chief priests and elders did not accept his baptism. What was John preaching? Repent. What did that imply?
Sin.
You're sinners. You're guilty. Who did repent? Jesus said. Tax collectors and prostitutes. And because they acknowledged their sin and had a penitent heart, it prepared the way for them to believe the gospel John was preaching. This is the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world. Jesus made the statement that unless you become like little children, you won't enter the kingdom. Pride is a barrier. You can know everything. Pride is the barrier. So I humble myself and acknowledge my guilt. I cannot be right with God, and I'm not interested, as I ought to be, in a remedy for that problem, which is Jesus Christ. Good observation, Todd. I don't know about the form of these men. They look like men. Whether or not they had flesh and blood bodies, I don't know about all of that. But they certainly look like men to both Abraham and Lot.
It's interesting there's no mention of them having a glow or anything. No way, he saw them way off and he's running out to greet them and everything.
That's right. No halo, no glow, no wings. That's right. Okay, so Lot urged them, verse 2, to come in and wash their feet, and then early the next morning they go their way. They said, no, we're going to spend the night in the square. And Lot knows their city, his city. And he said, no, he wanted them to come, very strongly urged them to come to his house. And he knew what might happen if they were spending the night in the square. He knew that city. 2 Peter tells us about Lot's soul being oppressed day by day by day, about the sensual conduct of those around him. I'm not sure how long Lot lived in Sodom. Back in chapter 13, when Abraham and Lot separated, it looks like it's either at the time or shortly after the time his age is identified as 75. And here we are, Abram's nearly 100. So I don't know if that whole period Lot was there in Sodom or not, but for some time. And he was oppressed by the circumstances that he was living in. So it's interesting, verse 4, before they lay down, the men of the city. This shows you how corrupted the city was. We already learned from the previous chapter, you couldn't find 10 righteous people in the city. When you get to verse 4, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house. Now note, to emphasize, both young and old, age doesn't make a difference. You think, old men? Yeah, old men too, young and old. All the people from every quarter, I guess that would include whatever social status you were. This city was depraved. You look around you today and you see so many people talking about homosexuality and lesbianism, and it's on the rise. It's sad, and you may get discouraged. Folks, we're not at Sodom yet. I can count more than 10 righteous people right here. It's bad, but it's not that bad. So lift up your heads and lift up your hearts. I don't live in Sodom. It looks like it sometimes, but it's not that bad. And so Lot was a man of courage. He went out to meet them at the doorway and shut the door behind him. He went out and faced this mob. Whatever you do with his statement in verse 8 about offering his daughters is not out of a lack of courage. I don't know why he offered his daughters. It's one of the difficult things, one of the difficult stories. It just seems, first of all, so evil and wrong. And yet Lot is called a righteous and godly man in 2 Peter. Is this simply a blot on his character? Could be. Maybe that's the simplest way to look at it. Good and righteous men sometimes do things that are so inconsistent with their character. David was a good and righteous man. Practiced adultery, engaged in conspiracy, had a man murdered, lied about it for 9 months. So I don't know. I think there's another possibility. I don't know if it's a reasonable possibility. I'll just throw it out. If your loved one died outdoors and you found them in a short length of time and buzzards were coming and they're getting ready to eat on your loved one, you had in your hand your beloved pet, maybe a little dog or a cat, might you throw that animal, toss it toward the buzzards? Why would you not be afraid to do that? Buzzards won't eat live things. You know that when you did it. And scaring them away, maybe give you an opportunity to rescue your loved one or whatever. Lot knew these men. Instead of an act of ungodliness, and I don't know this now, this is just throwing it out for thought. Maybe it was a cunning plan of a shrewd man. I'll offer my daughters. I know they won't take them. I know they won't. You're going to come up with 100 reasons why that won't work. It's okay. It's just something to think about. If that was his plan, if he had another plan to follow that, whatever it was, it didn't work. Because they're ready to, they're in mob mindset now. And so you see that the angel got his hands, drug him in the door, told him to get his family and get out of there. And so verse 13, warning, we're about to destroy this place. So Lot tried to get his family. His sons-in-law said, it evidently to them, he appeared to them as he was just jesting. Oh, come on, Lot. When you talk to people about Jesus coming again, same thing. And so when morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, up, take your wife, your two daughters who are here, and you'll be swept away in the punishment of the city. But he hesitated. You know, we judge Lot's wife because she looked back. But Lot was a little hesitant too at first. Isn't that interesting? And so the men seized his hand, the hand of his wife, the hand of his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him. What a compassionate God. They brought him out, put him outside the city. Verse 17, that very famous passage, one that the Lord referred to when he was talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, Luke 17:32. We got it on your lesson there. Remember Lot's wife, don't look back. So they fled. She lingered behind Lot, looked back, became a pillar of salt. Well, I'm out of time. I got to say something about the end of the chapter. I ask you on your questions. Look at your questions. I ask you, how many of Lot's family did he lose physically? How many?
Three.
Wife and two sons-in-law. How many of his family did he lose spiritually? Everyone. Is all those nice pastures and all that wealth worth it? It'd be interesting if you could ask Lot. And then I ask you, what's the origin of the Moabites and Ammonites? I don't know how old these daughters were at this time. This is the second specific account of someone using alcohol to get their purposes. What was the first one? Noah. Boy, alcohol is sure having a good history, isn't it? Isn't that a wonderful thing that people can consume? Two daughters sleeping with their daddy, having children, origin of the Moabites and Ammonites. Lot wouldn't have done that if he was sober. But alcohol takes away those moral restraints. Yes.
Do you have any idea whether or not they thought that they were the last people on earth?
They said that. But remember, they're looking at it from the standpoint, all they see is what happened to their city and all the people in their city. Two cities completely gone. So I don't know if they actually believed that or if that was their excuse. I don't know. But that's what they said. They said, our Father's not here, and there's not a man on earth to come into us after the man of the earth. Really? That's certainly true. We will be attacked when we stand for right. And here's another lesson. I'm out of time. So we'll have to end our class. Thank you for all your good comments this evening.